since I don't seem to be identified on any of the programs, I'll identify myself. I'm Bill Everett, Chairman of the Committee on Telecommunications of the National Academy of Engineering, and I'm retired Dean of Engineering at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, which means I reach statutory senility. One time I was to be introduced at a Rotary meeting, and the fellow who was supposed to introduce me didn't show up. He gave the job to somebody else who started out and says, these notes I have here say this man needs no introduction. I'm sure glad of that because I never heard of him before. Actually, I'm here today as a substitute for Peter Goldmark, who was to, and I'll explain his relationship and in our setup in a moment, but I'm a substitute for him. And another time when I had to substitute, I explained as I started that I was a substitute, and then explained a substitute, something like a window pane that gets broken and you fill it in its place with a piece of this oiled paper, and that keeps out the weather and lets the light through, but not very completely. After I gave my talk, a lady came up and said, oh, Dean Everett said, I certainly enjoyed a talk. Your talk, you were no substitute, you were a real pain. And now, the thing which we're discussing today is a portion of a report called Communications Technology for Urban Improvement. This was finished last summer under a contract with the Department of Housing and Urban Development, whose representative particularly was Alan Siegel, and he's here with us today. And when we come time for the discussion, I'm going to ask him to join the panelists because he's had a great deal to do with developing the program and also was the organizer of today's session. Our Committee on Telecommunications was initially organized 4 years ago at the request of the then President's Task Force on Telecommunications, which was a government task force, and they requested the National Academy of Engineering to set up an advisory group of engineers primarily to give advice on some of the technical problems that were appearing before this government committee, largely consisting of non-engineers. In fact, there were some rumors around that this group had said the engineers have failed in the administration of the spectrum. Now we'll let the economists and the lawyers show how it should be done. They published a report at the end of the Johnson administration, which, if you recall, ancient history was about 1968. And we published three reports because we had three subcommittees, one primarily on problems of the spectrum administration, another one primarily on long-distance communication, including satellites, cables, and open wire lines, and another one essentially on the relation of telecommunications to urban problems. And in fact, we published three separate reports about that time. One of them was telecommunications for enhanced metropolitan function and form, which was primarily the report of the urban panel, which was chaired by Peter Goldmark. In that program, we suggested further studies that should be made, and this was continued under the panel chairmanship of Peter Goldmark, then of Columbia Broadcasting System. He had a great many interests in this matter of urban problems, including the possibility of providing alternatives through telecommunications to making a better life for the city. And the Department of Housing and Urban Development financed a continuation of our study under Peter Goldmark as chairman of the panel, while I still continued as chairman of the overall telecommunication committee. We had some other reports, such as one on application of social and economic values to the spectrum management, which were chaired primarily by Henri Businis, and a report of that is also available. In fact, if you are interested in the committee reports, we have a list of the committee reports on the front table. There are four major reports. The one that we're talking about primarily today, Telecommunications for Enhanced Metropolitan Function and Form, the one I just mentioned also, Application of Social and Economic Values to Spectrum Management, both an interim and a final report, and also one on Communications Technology for Urban Improvement, which was the 1969 report. And today we have picked out certain sections of this report, mainly three sections. In our urban panel, we had sub-panels on such things as administration and emergency services, cities of the future, which was Peter Goldmark's particular interest, and which has been funded for a continuing area, particularly in Connecticut at the present time, and Peter is head of that. One on communication cities for the systems for the city, one on crime prevention, one on education, training, recreation, and culture, another one on environment and health, another one on transportation, and then we had a separate group set up to discuss what we had accomplished, because so often committees are, particularly committees predominantly made up of engineers, are criticized because they say they do not consider what people want. And so we had a special panel on urban attitudes to the suggestions we were making. And among other things, Gus Henningberg, who will speak to you, the last one of the three, organized a group, a meeting over in Newark a year ago, about a year ago, in which we brought together a number of urban representatives from all over the country to react to the proposals of the program. tying these several individual suggestions together was a network that was proposed primarily by Dick Gifford of the General Electric Company, but not functioning in his corporate duties or image, I would say, proposed a method of tying together through a network of telecommunication systems, a system of systems, you might say, the various services that can be used. And that will be the first discussion of the afternoon by Mr. Gifford.
Thank you, Bill. Now, I'm glad that I didn't bother to scrape together some jokes before I came here today, because I've learned now that when you follow Bill, he's used them all before you get up here. I think I ought to set the stage for a moment. When we were in the middle of our committee activities and working in panel areas such as medicine or transportation or law enforcement or public safety, whatever term you want to use, it became evident that many of us were starting to talk about the same technologies. We're talking about different end purposes that we wanted to apply those technologies, but there seemed to be some common threads of technology coming through each of these. And it was about in the middle of that work that I started to do some thinking, and at the direction of the chairman of the committee, towards how might we pull all this together in some way that one could see something building for the future. And it was this commonness that I saw among the various activities that led me into this material that I'll share with you today. And I guess I have to say that I start from a position that one can't look upon a city any longer as a happening. This is actually what we've been doing when you think about it. If you go way back in time, certainly that's exactly what it was. It happened to be at the crossroads. It happened to be at the shoreline where there was a change from one form of transportation to another. It happened to be at some point which there might be market exchange and so on. And what happened from then on was simply a happening. And what has been happening, actually, for the last several thousand years has been just that. But we now are aware of the fact that there are, through the media of technology, many possibilities in terms of how to make this happening operate in a little more efficient manner and hopefully, and more importantly, in a little more human manner, as we end up trodden on top of each other when we're operating in the happening environment. Now, if we're going to start structuring then something in the way of a system, we need some sort of a concept with which to start. And it's just been a habit of mine to think of groups of people as being simply a larger embodiment of the human body. In other words, the same thing as St. Paul used in his letters, the concept of a corporate body made up of literally hundreds, thousands, millions of people. And if you start working on that basis, you can get some very nice analogies and some very handy analogies when you start to develop some system thinking with regards to the city. And of course, when you start thinking in those terms, it's quite obvious when you want to talk about communications, you are talking about the nerve system of the city. And what we are concerned with then here today is the development of a more comprehensive, interrelated, planned out nerve system for the city. Now, communications can perform for these larger corporate bodies, in this case, a large assemblage of people, in the same way as nerve systems perform for each of us. And you can divide up those elements of control that are needed in the city much the same way one can divide up the functions that one has to be concerned with in regards to the human body. For instance, you can start off with the idea of the need for some central facilities of information to reach all inhabitants simultaneously with some provision for acknowledgement or feedback. Well, in the human body, there has to be some method by which the basic signal to freeze, to erupt into blast, or to whatever you're going to do, to come from the top. There has to be some nerve system to permit that sort of reaction. There has to be a need for distributed centers of public services to exchange continuously large amounts of information so that each point of access can be fully informed as to the other. Consider now the centers of information in our body, the various segments of our brain. They cannot operate in total isolation. There's a constant exchange going on. This sort of exchange has to go on in regards to the urban environment, where there are centers of information, such as libraries, hospitals, government city halls, community city halls, and so forth. This exchange has to go on continually. There's a need for some sort of central facilities for urban management, able to sense the status of the city in all times, for traffic control, key vehicle location, fire alarms, pollution warning, and so on. You need some way to gather all the sense information, the ability of us to receive information through our eyes, our smell, our touch, taste, and so forth. Somehow all of that has to be combined, and from that, the proper programs up here, we finally reach a decision as to whether there's a necessary reaction has to be taken. A city is going to have something of the same order, some sort of a sensing system to determine whether it's getting choked to death with the traffic or choked to death with pollution or whatever it might be. There has to be some method by which you can see how this large number of cells of individual humans are operating in such a way that they can at least live together and not trample all over each other. And then finally, of course, there's the need for, in the human environment, a need for each cell of this large system to be able to get in contact with another cell. There isn't quite the same equivalent in this regard in the human body, but I think we certainly sense the ability, the desire in our corporate human body of a city for the individual cells to be able to access any other individual cell. And finally, there's a need for communication for some of the work functions of the body. In other words, the individual muscle controls of the body, the various transportation functions, the waste disposal functions, energy input functions, law enforcement, and so forth. All these functions have to have supporting nerve systems of their own to perform their particular muscular function. Now, to perform these types of services today, we have several sort of overlays of nerve systems. And again, most of these are happenings. Happenings as a consequence of various inventions and simply overlaid on top of the older invention. Certainly, the mechanization of the newspaper was a fantastic move in the direction of a nerve system to get information out from one source to many people. And as a matter of fact, it wasn't but shortly after the mechanization of the newspaper, the ability to get for a few cents news out on the street to everyone, that the power of the press really started to move forward, and its first sample of its power came forth, of course, in the Spanish-American War. Another form that was used today is, of course, publishing houses, very much the same. And with a paperback, I think you've all seen in this past couple of weeks how fast the reaction can be. The president's trip to China, within 4 days after his return back from China, there was a paperback on the stands with full pictures of the trip, full text of all the statements and everything else. So mechanization has increased the power of that type of nerve system. Of course, you're familiar with the radio, the AM radio, FM radio, and the TV type of systems. Again, basically getting information out. Mail is another nerve system that we have. However, mail is slowly getting outmoded in comparison to some of these others in terms of reaching individual people. Time, on the time dimension. Regular telephone service, of course, enables one cell to reach another cell, and it is used in another form under leased arrangements to provide the interconnection of some of the major information centers in the city. Well, so it goes. You have this wide variety of different types of nerve systems, some of them being things that developed a long time ago in the early days of the Industrial Revolution, others being in the electronic or the information revolution, but all of them being sort of just random pieces. And what I was trying to do was try to pull these together into some sort of thoughts on which a sort of a skeletal structure of a nerve system on which one could build for future urban improvements, applying some of the various programs that the committee was studying. Now, towards this end, I structured four basic networks. Now, mind you, there is a fifth, but it isn't a single network. The fifth that is not in the talk here is the concept of there being networks or individual communication systems for special purposes. Again, come back to, let's say, the police system. They'll have their own information network. Their base station to police cars to patrolmen and so forth. Transportation will have its own network, nerve network, and so on. I'm not covering those. Those are isolated nerve systems, much as I said before, as cover the individual muscle controls in our bodies. What I'm going to deal with are those nerve systems that are comprehensive and they're applicable across the board throughout the city. Now, the first of these, the one that I would consider most primary, and I'm sure you'd agree with that, is what I would call the full two-way switched voice network. And I, at the moment, described it as voice. It may move up someday to some form of video information. But the basic feature of this is in the term full two-way switched. It's the concept of any one cell being able to reach any other cell. And the nerve system is optimized around that concept. All questions regarding loading from various points, the go into the picture in the design of this type of a network. You have to design it for peak traffic. You have to design it for different times of day, type of traffic, and so forth. It's optimized around the concept of two-way switched.
I forgot to put this thing around here, Dave.
I don't. All right, I'm moving away. I think you can hear him anyway, but I was told to do
it. I will drop.
Yeah, I got it. Just a minute. Okay. All right. So the first of these is the regular two-way telephone network, and it is a very fine, basic type of nerve system, provided we think of it and use it in terms of its basic function. And again, I emphasize the two-way switched, random access type of convenience of that network. Now, we will physically apply pieces of it in other forms through leased circuits and things like that. But the basic network is in that form. Now, the second network that I structured, next slide, was the network of a cable, coaxial cable type of distribution from a head-end source, which might be a cable head-end or a Department of Education or some other generating point for information, with fairly broad bandwidth of information out, a pipe into the homes, carrying 30, 60, whatever number you want, with time it'll increase, equivalent of TV channels. And then a fairly thin route, reverse circuit, since you are going to have, in essence, a means to get into every home, you might as well use that means as a sensing circuit. Later we'll come back to a sensing network for the city, but here's an element of sensing that can be used with regards to the conditions in homes, and it can be quite readily fed back on that type of technical facility. Mind you, this is basically, though, a distribution out type of form. This would be something that is another alternative, an electronic alternative, more instantaneous in terms of newspapers, mail, magazines, books, and of course, general entertainment and educational materials. Next slide. Now, the third network that was structured in the report was one which is called at the moment, a 30 channel. Actually, you could, of course, go up later as technology moves it up. You could pair up the cable and make it 60 channel. Two-way video with limited access and limited switching capability. And the concept here was there are several information centers in a city. For instance, you would want to move City Hall out into the neighborhoods. People want to be able to access City Hall in a comfortable manner. They don't want to have to get on a bus to go to City Hall. They want to be able to actually, ideally, walk to City Hall. And at City Hall, you want all the information, the neighborhood City Hall, all the information that would be available in any main City Hall. You need essentially a big bundle of nerves back to that central file information or the central personnel information that might be needed. Similarly, between hospitals, nursing homes, educational centers, libraries, there are information centers. There are sort of cells of information in a city, and the concept here was to interconnect these with a full two-way video cable. And I indicate on this chart that there may be some switching capability. The thought was, at first, you generally would leave the connections patched on the basis that between these hours and these hours, I need to have three channels between this point and this point. I think with time, you'd get into a more automatic switching, but again, rather limited compared to the full two-way voice-type system. Now, the fourth circuit, next slide. The fourth network that was structured is what I call the Environmental Status Reporting Network, or the Sensing Network. And here the idea was to find some way for the city to know what's going on within itself. Now, mind you, I've already picked up the point on the information from the homes via the distribution network. Now I'm trying to pick up information outside the homes. In this case, it could be such things as weather, pollution, traffic loading, vehicle location, particularly bus systems, knowing where the buses are, police vehicle location, and so forth. Now, someone might say, well, why structure that as a network? Generally, sensing information is very narrow-band information, and again, in the time base, is very infrequent information. If you update sensing information like every minute, that's a very frequent update, generally. And the thought was that by sharing a network, in other words, if you have sensing points, receivers and sensors for pollution and radio receivers and things like that, at some point you could now hard cable, hard wire those systems back to some distribution point in an economical manner, because you'd be sharing the one cable with a wide variety of signals, sensing all different types of information. And it was felt that by building a network on this basis, you could get a much more economic base on which to develop the concept of sensing in the management of an urban system. Now, let me just hold there for a minute. At this point, then, we had structured four, and I'm going to put this word in, I should have put in earlier, conceptual networks. Let me go back over that one again, conceptual networks. The physical aspect of it, I'm not going to determine. That's a function of economics and engineering when you get to actually plan in detail the specific project you have in mind. It may well be, at the start, that the cable for distribution to the homes could be used in some areas for interconnecting a couple of libraries and just peel 10 channels off and say we won't make that available to the homes in that area. It might be that the sensing network actually uses the cables that are in the ground right now for the full two-way switch voice network, only you just simply assign them out and lease and leave them permanently assigned out. In other words, there are many ways in which one can arrive at the final physical embodiment of these networks, in which there'll be economic trade-offs and also trade-offs in recognition of what is already in the ground. What I was trying to get at is that in doing the thinking in this subject, one has to first start, though, with an idea of some sort of broad conceptual thinking, and that's what the suggestions are here for in these four networks. Now, how you would use them, let me show on this next chart. This is a rundown of the many projects that were developed in the report. And we won't describe each of them. I think the titles will give you some clue as to what they're dealing with. For instance, the Municipal Command Center. For it to operate effectively, it will need access to networks 1, 2, 3, and 4. Let's go down for a moment to something like telemedicine. It needs access to the telephone, the two-way switch network. It needs something in the way of distribution information, primarily to the homes for medicine education materials, and certainly needs network 3 for the exchange of information from one hospital to the other. So in the case there's an expertise in one hospital and the patient calls another hospital because of the emergency nature of it, that expertise can be shared quite readily via network 3. And as you go on down here, I think you can start to see the pattern that if you're going to put in any one of these items, such as a transit information system, and the book deals here with several elements to that system, you find that you cannot afford to put in network 2 or network 3 on the basis of the requirements of transit only. But when you add up the requirements of the transit system and the telemedicine system and the nursing home care and the two-way educational delivery and community information centers and things like that, now you start to see the load that justifies putting in this type of a network. And it was at this point then that I think the city planners started to have the lights turn on. They started to see why we were talking about these four networks and how they would fit into the longer range scheme of things. Now, someone says, well, that's still all very fine, but there's still one problem, and that is that to put in those networks, even if you do some piggybacking on various ones, is an awful lot of money, and you'll just never get the bird off the ground. And here, we didn't go into a lot of calculations, but in general, you would find that if you take a look at a city of 500,000 or up, the amount of dollars that would be put into networks 2, 3, and 4 combined would be about one-fifth of the dollars that is already existing in network 1. In other words, the investment necessary to achieve the basic functions of network 2, 3, and 4 would be somewhere about one-fifth of the dollars of network 1, the installed dollars of network 1. I think you can see that quite readily in that network 1 generally is about $1,000 a station, and network 2, which you might be quite familiar with, $200 a home, a terminal, and of course generally a little less homes than our stations, telephone stations. So I think you can start to see the pattern there, and if you plot it out, it would be about one-fifth the dollars necessary that you to what you already have in the form of a two-way switched voice network now. And then if you want to try some startling comparisons, you can get some fantastic ratios if you do these in regards to the continued movement of more concrete parking lots, transportation facilities, and things like that. When you start to look at the trade-offs in that area, they become quite attractive in favor of putting in basic networks such as were structured here. I understand we're going to be taking questions later, is that right? All right, well, I'll leave it at this point and indicate that the next speaker will be talking about one possible application of communications in this environment, and as he's talking, you might be able to think of the ways in which any one of those four networks might be of use in his particular application. But realize that there were at least 20 other applications with similar types of demands on such networks as these, and these are all covered in the total report. Thank you, Bill.
As Dick says, we are going to have the three papers presented first, and then later we'll have the discussion, and we'll have not only Alan Siegel of HUD, but also Mr. Rosinski, of, who was executive secretary for our program and tied together much of what we were doing. I have also been asked to make certain number of announcements, which I didn't do to begin with because people keep coming in. There's an announcement that says, in response to many requests, we're asking attendees to refrain from smoking. Rather than making no smoking signs, we're seeking voluntary cooperation. Then I notice the committee provides ashtrays available for all of you. But the important part is that in the survey cards, the student monitors who will distribute these survey cards will collect session cards. They're supposed to help IEEE plan future programs. And they asked me to make several announcements during the session because people do come and go requesting attendees to fill out those cards and return them upon leaving. So if you leave before the end of the session, please give those cards in at that time. As was mentioned, we ended up with about 18 different suggestions of different ways in which telecommunication can improve urban living. We were only talking about telecommunications in attacking the problems of urban living, and none of us would claim that that is the only major problem in our urban difficulties. But we had a general principle in our committee, which was along the line that if various groups of engineers would attack various problems, then later we can assemble them into a consideration of a total system. There are many various discussions about the urban problem. For instance, I got one announcing some discussions that are going to take place at the University of Colorado, which I thought was rather interesting. The particular suggestion that caught my eye was one by Waller Orr Roberts, who is the head of the Upper Atmosphere Group, National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder. And he made a statement which I think may be questioned, but it shows how people are thinking. It says, most people don't realize in all probability the only way to live in the future is going to be in the cities. The idea of urban life being unattractive and people wanting to get back to the suburbs and the country must be abandoned. We'll live in gigantic beehives with schools, stores, theaters, and gymnasiums in that building if we're going to preserve the quality of the land around. The way cities are going with horizontal spread to the suburbs is not satisfactory for the future. One thing I think that nobody can question is that as the congestion increases, the problems of telecommunication become more severe. There's also one major direction that I think everyone is interested in, and that is the problem of health care. We were very fortunate in being able to get both an electrical engineer and a MD in one person, who is both at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And when I tried to contact him last week, I found him at the Massachusetts General Hospital. But he was the leading light in our discussion of telemedicine for improved medical care. So I'd like to introduce Dr. Mark, both an electrical engineer and a doctor of medicine. So you want to give your... Well, let me forget this thing again. I don't believe in these myself, but being a communication engineer, but I was ordered to use them. Let me get...
Thank you. medical care, or the medical care system, as it's set up, as you probably know, really is a hierarchical system. It's multi-leveled. When you first have a problem, you seek out the lowest level of medical care, usually referred to as the primary care level. You try to find a physician to whom you can walk in off the street and complain you have a headache or a backache or a cold or whatever, and you need relief. Now, the source of that care generally comes from the so-called primary care physician, and this includes internists, general practitioners, family physicians, pediatricians for children, primarily. In a very high percentage of cases, your problem is taken care of at that level. It may be a one-visit situation, it may be two or three visits, and the problem is solved. However, in a smaller percentage of cases, you move up to a next higher order level of care, which might mean hospitalization in your local hospital or referral to a more specialized physician in your area or both. For example, if you started off with a headache and your primary care physician followed you along with that headache for a reasonable period of time with no improvement, he may determine that a little more technology is needed. Perhaps he'd want an electroencephalogram, he might want to do a lumbar puncture, and so on, and he might well hospitalize you for a workup or refer you to a neurologist. The same thing might be true of a backache, which needed to be worked up more thoroughly, and after pain pills didn't help and it didn't cure itself, your primary care physician might hospitalize you for x-rays, myelograms, or whatever in the hospital. And frequently, this too, in a high percentage of cases, solves the problem. When the workup is completed and a diagnosis is made or treatment is given, the problem is taken care of. But again, in a small percentage of cases, a higher order level of care is necessary, often necessitating transportation from your local area to a regional referral center of some kind or to a more sophisticated specialist. Your headache might require more sophisticated workup, maybe in the form of a radioisotope scan, or perhaps it would mean surgery, a surgical procedure on the brain. These kind of things often are not available in local hospitals, and you have to go to a referral center or a teaching hospital to be taken care of. Now, obviously, we all know there are problems with the healthcare delivery system in the United States at the present time. One of the problems is, of course, that it's very expensive and the prices keep going up and up. There's another problem, too, and that is that the availability of entry points into this system are often limited. The availability is limited. And this is not only true in rural areas where often reasonable-sized communities have a difficult, if not impossible, time attracting a primary care physician. But it's also true in our cities. It's true particularly in the center, the core cities. And it's probably also something that every one of you has experienced wherever you live. And maybe many of you live in the suburbs where the primary care physician is found in greatest abundance. I was interested to read an article in the current New England Journal of Medicine on the way down here this morning, written by some investigators at Yale, Schoenfeld, Heston, and Falk, in which they attempted to make an analysis of the number of primary care physicians which would be required to give good care as judged by physicians in practice. And they concluded that somewhere in the order of 133 physicians per 100,000 people population would represent the level necessary to give good care. If you just average out across the country, it turns out that there are only approximately one half of that number currently in the practice of delivering primary health care. So this problem of a limitation of entry points into the healthcare system is a real one, just on the basis of the number of available physicians. But it's even worse than that, as the first slide will indicate to you, because physicians who are delivering health care are not distributed equally across population, but rather they tend to cluster in those counties as shown on the slide, where population is heaviest. And I guess this is obvious to those of us who live in cities or in suburbs. We, in the counties with most population, have the highest ratio of physicians to patients. Whereas if you go to rural areas, centers of low population density, you find that the ratio drops way down. Now this graph uses a different type of definition of a physician than the article does. We're considering here all physicians who are involved in patient care, in a not just those involved in primary health care. So in this, you would lump psychiatrists and surgeons and OBGYN and so on, everyone all together, but all physicians who are involved in patient care. Okay, you can turn that slide off now. So this is probably one of the biggest problems in the medical care system. And it's a problem which is not going to disappear overnight. It's a problem that is not going to be solved simply by making more doctors, although that's certainly one direction in which people are trying to go. But it takes a long time to gear up new medical schools and to double the number of physicians involved in primary health care. Efforts are also being made to redirect and remotivate physicians who are now in training. And I think you find a higher percentage of medical students who are now in school will go into the primary health care field rather than into highly sophisticated specialties. I think this is something that's coming, judging from the attitudes of medical students now. Nevertheless, the problem won't be solved in the near future simply by making more doctors. And I think everybody agrees that it is necessary to improve healthcare delivery systems, invent new ways, innovative systems, which add up to a more effective and equitable utilization of what limited resources we do have at the present time. And also, I think it's important to recognize at the outset that we're talking about really redesigning the entire system. Piecemeal solutions will not solve the problem. And I think this is extremely important for those of us who are interested in the applications of technology to medical care. We have to be careful that we don't focus our attention and our eyes on small areas of the problem. We have to be careful we don't put our money and time, for example, into making highly sophisticated intensive care units in hospitals, which end up benefiting a very small percentage of the total population, and in fact really don't address themselves to what really is the problem in medical care now. So what we want is a system which will amplify and significantly extend the capabilities of an individual physician, both in the geographical area he can cover and in the number of patients he can take care of. It is at the present time widely accepted that a reasonable component of improving the health care would be to utilize allied health personnel, to delegate to non-physician people certain responsibilities involved in patient care, and to multiply thereby the efforts of a given physician. And so you see around the country many programs springing up which are beginning to train nurses to operate in new roles, expanded roles of nurse practitioner. And maybe some of you have already begun to have some experience having your children taken care of by pediatric nurse practitioners, so that the physician himself no longer will do the well baby checkup and the routine immunizations. Such a nurse practitioner is involved in geriatric care also and in adult medicine. There is, as you also know, an increasing effort to train the so-called medics, the ex-corpsmen, to function in the role of physician assistants. I think it's also clear that in the development of innovative medical care systems, technology has a role to play. And the kinds of technology that are most obviously going to be important are communications. Telecommunications will surely have an important role here. Transportation systems are going to be important. And obviously, computers are already demonstrating their importance and will become increasingly so. Now, I think that from the point of view of the healthcare planner, he must be cautious, especially now, You know, now technologists are eagerly looking for new markets for their wares. Companies involved in telecommunications who have been previously working, for example, in a space program or whatever, are eagerly looking for other places to win their wares. And so companies that have been building these kind of systems are looking into medicine. Is this a place where we can apply our expertise? Well, it may be. But from the point of view of the health planner, he has to be very careful that he doesn't end up being involved in an absurd application of technology. And we as engineers, I think, in investigating applications for our technology, must consider how our technology affects the total system of healthcare delivery in terms of how that system operates as a healthcare delivery system. We may find it, and basically, I think I should say at the present time that in telemedicine and in healthcare, I don't think that technology is really a problem. I think the techniques are here. I don't think it's very difficult to imagine how it would be possible to allow a physician to talk to and interact on a personal level via two-way interactive television with a patient remotely in Appalachia or Alaska. That technology has been demonstrated and is here. But I think it's not so obvious how you go about designing a healthcare system built around a certain technology and whether, in fact, that kind of bandwidth is justified from a cost-benefit point of view. I think it's this area that I want to concentrate on now. Let me define for you telemedicine as we use the term, and I'll do it by means of the next slide. I think that when we speak of telemedicine, we're talking about any system utilizing physicians, medical technology, physician assistants, communication systems, and transportation systems, such that it permits the physician or group of physicians to take care of patients located remotely from him at a different point in space. And as you see here on the slide, we've represented a center of medical technology where the doctors live and where the local hospital is here and labeled it a group practice because that's probably the most reasonable form for this base to take. We'd have several physicians working together in a team located in in or next to a reasonable-sized community hospital. And then a series of remote clinics, each manned by an individual we've termed here a physician assistant. Now, we haven't defined what a physician assistant is. It could be a medex, it could be a nurse practitioner, it could even be a physician, in a sense. In which this system serves to back him up. Each of these clinics then is connected to the central group practice by means of a communication system of some kind and a transportation system. So that the entry point into this medical care system is at the local clinic. Patients with their problems enter the remote clinic and are seen initially by the physician assistant. If it's a new complaint, an acute problem, the physician assistant is perfectly capable of obtaining the necessary medical data relative to that problem, taking a history, doing a physical examination, doing the indicated laboratory tests. The capability of non-physicians to perform this task has been well documented in a variety of situations. A certain fraction of those input problems can be adequately cared for by the physician assistant by means of applying standing orders given to the physician assistant by the doctors. And in some situations, notably a program in the MedX program running at Dartmouth Medical School, protocols and algorithms have been worked out which make it possible for the physician assistant simply to follow the algorithm. Ask the questions, obtain the given data, and if the answers are appropriate, then you do the following. And in a certain fraction of cases, the patient never does see a physician. Pediatric nurse practitioners who see many, a high fraction of pediatric caseload as well baby checkups or minor problems, it's been estimated that the nurse practitioner can probably take care of somewhere in the order of 80% of the input problems. But in a certain fraction of cases, that won't be possible, and a physician must be involved. Must be involved either to write orders for certain kinds of drugs or to change drugs, or involved to give consultation and to apply medical judgment to the situation. And in these cases, a teleconsult or a consultation via the communication system is going to be necessary. Hence the use of the communication system. This will help solve another fraction of cases, and then finally, some of those problems will not be solved adequately, and it will be determined that the patient must come to the center for treatment, and hence the use of the transportation system. Now, this is what we mean by telemedicine system. Obviously, it could be applied in a remote area where distance is a problem, but it turns out that, as a matter of fact, our own interest centers on an urban problem, and that is the problem of taking care of patients in nursing homes. Because it just so happens that patients in nursing homes represent a population which also live in relative medical isolation for a variety of reasons which have to do with availability of physicians and the way they're reimbursed and the type of patients who live in nursing homes. It's extremely difficult to get a physician to come into a nursing home to see a patient who develops a problem. And they are, in many respects, even more isolated than patients who live in rural villages where there's no doc in town. And so in this case, these remote clinics would represent nursing home locations, and the center might represent the hospital which discharged those patients. Now, having defined what telemedicine is, now the next question is, where does telecommunications come in here, and what are the engineering implications, and how does one go about planning a system like this and justifying the applications of the technology? Measuring how a medical system works is a very tough problem. Measuring quality of medical care has never really been solved. However, it is possible to analyze a system like this on the basis of its operational characteristics. And that makes a certain amount of sense. That is, if we worry about things like how many patients per unit time can this system handle, what percentage of the time are the professionals involved in the system busy, what is the patient waiting time to receive definitive care in this system, and so on, we end up with a model which, and if we use these as measures of effectiveness, we end up a model that can be used. It's quantitative, and it can act as a reasonable guide to at least give us an approximation of whether the system is reasonable or ridiculous. And the kinds of data that we need for this kind of a model are things like the rate at which patients come into the clinic, the length of time it takes for a physician assistant to work up the patient, the probabilities involved that a patient will have to have a consult or will have to be transported to the center, the times involved in these consultations and transportation, and so on. With these kinds of data, it's possible to build a model and to solve the model for the various parameters I've mentioned. And I think I'll just focus on one consideration, and that is the consideration of how much bandwidth is necessary to design, in some sense, an optimal system. And let me start by saying I don't know. I don't think anybody knows right now, but we do know that several approaches have been tried. The problem is they've been tried in situations where there has been no model or no attempt to analyze the system as a system. At one extreme, one might imagine that the communication link is simply a telephone line and people talk to each other. And this experiment's been done and is still going on in New Mexico, where the University of New Mexico's Department of Community Medicine has taken on responsibility for caring for a population in a town of Estancia, which is approximately 100 miles away. A nurse clinician runs a clinic in Estancia and is coupled to the medical school simply by telephone. She also has available a Greyhound bus that can carry x-rays so that she's dealing with a narrow-band system. Nevertheless, that system seems to be performing a reasonably good function. At the other extreme, there has been some experience with two-way real-time video in which the philosophy has been to examine how many of the physician's functions in patient interviewing and physical diagnosis can be done remotely over a television link. This experiment was done at the Mass General Hospital in Boston. And it was successfully demonstrated that physicians and patients can interact well over the television link, that the physician certainly can listen to the chest, listen to the lungs, he can examine various portions of the body. He can't feel the abdomen, however. Nevertheless, he can do a reasonable patient workup with the help of a nurse practitioner at the other end. I think, obviously, in thinking about how this system would work, there is clearly going to be a trade-off between the bandwidth of the communication system and the sophistication of the physician assistant. The more sophisticated the physician assistant, the more you can believe her observations or his observations, and the narrower the bandwidth has to be. My personal feeling is, my bias is that, in fact, we don't need very wide bandwidth, that the requirements on the communication system are going to not require it, that we have to transmit certain kinds of information like EKGs for analysis, like perhaps patient records, but you don't have to transmit them in a hurry. And that it's not necessary to have real-time personal interaction or observation of patient variables, provided you invest your money in the training of the physician assistant. Nevertheless, I don't know that answer. I don't think anybody does. And I think what we're looking for and recommending as a result of these kind of considerations is that experiments in telecommunications and medical care be done, that telemedicine systems be established, but that they be set up and established in the context of a model which will encourage the proper observations to be made so that when the experiment is all over, you'll know something about what you really have done and how to generalize that experience.
I'll call attention again to the fact that we would like to have the cards filled out before you leave the room and given to the student monitors. As I mentioned before, we felt that it was essential that we should have feedback from the cities. And we secured, I think, a very remarkable individual. At least he has been very impressive to me in a variety of ways that we've reacted with him, and Gus Henningberg, who is director of the Newark Urban Coalition and served on our group that was getting reactions from the cities. Oh, just a typical little thing I remember that he commented one time. We were having a discussion about how telecommunications might make it reduce the loads on urban transportation so people could only do their shopping and not come into the city. And he pointed out to us that the cities didn't want any such development because they needed people coming into the cities, or the cities would wither and die even further than they have so far. I think there's one thing I ought to mention also today before I call Gus up here. A few years ago, I had a flannel board in which I gave a lecture, and you could stand off about a foot away and throw things at it, and they all stick very nicely. I found when I gave that lecture that if I didn't explain why things stuck up on the flannel board, why everybody was wondering what made it stuck and weren't paying any attention to what the speaker was saying. Well, Gus has got to come up here with one of these braces, and I know when I see anybody, I always wonder what happened to him. Well, I understand he's on something like Prometheus' bed where he has to be stretched because he isn't tall enough or something like that. But he has some problem that's developed recently in his nerves, and I've had some friends that have had this sort of thing. So he came to us nevertheless today to meet his commitment. And I'd like to call on Mr. Henningberg to discuss this problem of community reaction to communication technology. Gus?
Oops.
Yeah, this thing bounces up and down. Don't add a spill on top of everything else. Can this work here all
right?
Yeah,
I'll have to just set it on the floor.
Study here now.
I just discovered that you all can solve practical problems too. I didn't realize that. I suppose it would be appropriate, Bill, to tell everybody how I got this thing, but I'm not going to do it, primarily because when I first got it, I got bored with explaining it over and over, the same story, so I started making up stories. And I forgot which one was the real one. So I don't explain it anymore at all. I don't come as a scientist or a technologist, but nor to bring any suggestions for the kinds of things which have been discussed so far, but more to raise some questions with you about how do you sell this stuff after you develop it? How do you give it away after you develop it? And I guess what I'm concerned about is that I have a feeling that scientists, technologists, and engineers, and so on, decided within the group, so to speak, that we have talents, skills, which might have practical application for the cities, without any serious inquiry among the people who run the cities as to whether or not we want whatever skills you've got, have any mechanism to bring those skills into the city, and whether anybody's going to use them if we do that. And I think the question has some very serious ramifications. There obviously is no question in my mind as to whether or not the whole question of telemedicine would be useful in a city like Newark, or any of the individual components that were talked about earlier, the command center, the transportation. All of that's useful and necessary in one degree or another in the cities. But let's deal for a minute, if we can, with some of the political realities of the cities, as opposed to the national level now. First of all, once these things are developed and the money is generally expended at the national level for the development of such things, question then becomes one of how do you get it into Newark, New Jersey? When the city council in Newark, New Jersey, or New York City, or Washington, or wherever else you want to take it, doesn't understand what you're doing at all, they're in the throes of a financial crisis, and among the things which have been ripped out of virtually every city budget in the country is any money for research and development. To get a beleaguered city council to say, okay, we're going to set aside some money for research and development on an experiment that might take 3 years and may not work. While the school board is screaming, the police are screaming, the firemen are screaming for raises and so on, and you're laying off workers all over the place. Now, that's really a very serious political and economic reality. And if the people who have the talents to develop these kinds of systems don't look at that real problem at the same time, we may find ourselves in the position of having developed a very, very sophisticated process by which all of these services can be better provided, and yet not able to provide them because people simply haven't got the mechanisms to accept them. You have a second political problem. What you're basically talking about is change. You're looking at some existing systems and the poor and inefficient delivery of services, and you're saying, let's change it. But I think you ought to be aware also that most of the people who work in city governments and state governments are not only not aggressive advocates for change, they have become the most competent advocates for maintaining the status quo in our system. The temperament of civil servants is not oriented to change. Now that means that you're going to get a lot of resistance at the local level when you start going into a health department and saying, all right, we want to try something out, And we need to change this or change that or change the other thing to do it. Nobody is standing around there waiting with open arms, even if you can prove you're going to solve a very serious problem that they are concerned with, a problem they have identified. I also have some question as to whether or not the elected officials who theoretically, and I emphasize theoretically, run the cities, are any more attuned than the civil servants, than the permanent employees are. And of course, they've got another problem in that they're just there temporarily. The civil servants are there forever, which is one of the problems. If you could develop a system to replace civil servants every 4 years with something else, it would probably be welcomed at least by all the elected officials in the country, if nobody else. Yeah. Now, these become really very serious concerns of a kind which I think too little attention may have been given to within your own professional ranks. I think it calls for developing an additional capability, and that is increasing your own knowledge of the dynamics of the cities that you're trying to help, because you cannot promote these things, you can't even give them away in a vacuum. And unless there is an understanding of what they represent and a political acceptance of them, you will have accomplished really very little. The third dilemma is human and political, and I guess it has to do with credibility. It may be sort of harsh to say it, but I suspect your own credibility is much greater within your own ranks than your credibility is outside of your own ranks. Because I think there's been too little talking to city officials by scientists and technologists. Too little exchange back and forth between the two. I came to New York a year or so ago to a meeting called 2020, which had nothing to do with eyesight. It had to do with the year 2020. And it was called by some of America's leading planners. And what they had done was plan New York City for the year 2020. And I mean, they had planned it in infinite detail. This was a report out meeting, the result of several years of study. And they had even decided exactly how wide Fifth Avenue was going to be, how much the erosion would have been on Welfare Island by that time, and how wide it, and you know, it was really fantastic. And the mayor of New York was the luncheon speaker, and he got there 20 minutes late. And he got there late because it was raining in New York. And he doesn't ride the subways, he rides in a car, and it took him 90 minutes to get from City Hall to the Waldorf Astoria. And he basically said that I'm a little bit concerned about people who are planning for 50 years from now because it does two things. One, it permits them to skip over today's problems and deal with those in the future. And secondly, he said, if you all planned New York into the mess it's now in, I'm not sure I want you planning for me anymore. Now, take the parallel to your own area, and maybe we find a situation where elected officials don't understand what your capabilities are, and I don't think there's very much understanding on your part of what their problems are. And I guess really that was the only contribution that we were able to make, and felt sort of like a fish in the wrong pond, in listening to very learned and detailed discussions about command centers and wide bands and narrow bands and telemedicine and all the rest of it. It was a tremendous experience for me to have the opportunity to serve on the committee. But perhaps one of the most useful contributions that was made by us non-professionals was the meeting that Bill referred to when we brought about, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 city managers or their equivalents from around the country to sit down with the members of the committee and have the members of the committee say, okay, this is what we've dreamed up for your city. Now, all of the technologists who were involved had obviously felt this was a useful whatever it was because they had put tremendous time into it. But on some of the projects, the city managers basically said, well, that really is of no use to me. So I guess what I'm getting at is it may be necessary in testing the feasibility, beyond the technological feasibility, we need to develop a capability to examine the political feasibility of the things that you're concerned with. And finally, I suppose, a question of economics. It is obvious that, at least in the kind of city from which we come, and it is different, I think, from other cities only in degree, but not in kind, that the economic capability does not exist at the local level to implement any of the things that you're talking about. And in the proposals which I have seen and in the discussions which I have heard around these kinds of subjects, one thing that is missing, and I would recommend very strongly, again, is that in any funding which is developed at the national level or the state level or where else, wherever else, that money be built into the funding of these kinds of projects to hire people who have the ability to create an atmosphere in a community where there will be acceptance of the project that you're working on. Call them PR people, call them anything you want to. But you cannot promote these things with technicians alone. It is simply not possible to do that in an emotionally charged, economically starved city, which has all kinds of conflicts which will bear upon the problems you're dealing with, but which you may not be able to see and touch and measure. And it may call even for the development of a whole new profession, people who are able to communicate to a lay public and to a political public in their terms, in their language, the very technical things that you have devoted your talents to. And finally, I guess that unless we're able to do that, and unless we're able to take into account the very serious political and human realities of the cities, then the tremendous efforts which have been developed or put into the kinds of things we've talked about this morning will have no merit except having served as an occupier of the talents and time of the technicians who put it together.
Can't even see down there.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes, will you? Yeah. I think the thing which Gus has been saying applies not only to telecommunications, but in this whole problem of how the problems of the country and of the city, which are going to require certainly major inputs from engineers, because I've frequently said that, well, I don't think that engineers can say that they have the secret to how to solve our modern problems, yet I sincerely believe they are not going to be solved without the major contributions from the engineers. And I think the comments that Gus have said have indicated that they cannot be solved unless engineers and politicians and social scientists and others with inputs find better ways probably to work together than they have in the past. Now, I've also said from time to time that if I were reorganizing or starting engineering over from the beginning, I probably wouldn't suggest it be divided into electrical engineering, civil engineering, mechanical, and so forth, but that the major problems of engineering are the processing of information, the processing of materials, the processing of energy, and their assembly into systems, including, of course, the problems of biology as well. This afternoon, we're interested in talking not merely about the three things that have been presented, but other things, ways by which primarily the processing of information, and we use the word telecommunications in a very broad sense to imply the processing of telecommunications by any electrical means, including the use of computers, the storage of information, measurement of information, and so forth as well. So I'm going to ask the both those gentlemen who made presentations, also Alan Siegel,
who represents Housing and Urban Development and has been our major liaison, and Mr. Rosensky, who's been and still is our executive secretary, to come up here, and we'll open ourselves to any questions on this whole area of telecommunications as an aid in solving urban problems. Since we haven't heard from you before, and although I didn't tell you I was going to call on you, Alan, I wonder if you'd be willing to make some general comments on the government's, particularly the national government's role in the solving of urban problems and the using of technology to solve them. Since we are talking primarily to telecommunication engineers with that in mind, but also in the general field. You can either use that or this if you'd like to come up here. But in general, then we'll move around the microphone.
Let me just say a couple words, since I wasn't quite planning to do this. First of all, the Department of Housing and Urban Development has had a research program for a number of years, but really since 1969 is the first time it really became the beginnings of a significant program with a total of about $10 million. This year, this fiscal year, we have a $45 million research program, which to calibrate people, remember the Smithsonian runs $25 million a year for its research, the Veterans Administration $62 million. So for our $45 million, we are tackling the problems of housing and urban development. In addition, for most of the time, our department has been spelled housing in capital letters, urban development in little letters. And it's recently we've been attempting to try and correct that issue and actually expand it. And the president's reorganization has proposed a Department of Community Development, which is concerning far more than housing, far more than urban affairs, but the whole issue of community. In addition, though, there are a number of other federal departments concerned in the areas of domestic technology. Department of Transportation clearly has become much more visible in its concerns. And in addition, the National Science Foundation and its research applied to national needs has begun to tackle the problems of domestic affairs. And last, I would like to just point out the president and his messages on science and technology has really directed the civilian agencies and the high technology agencies to try to see in what ways technology can be applied to solve some of our pressing domestic problems. I think that's...
Thank you. Thank you, Alan. Are there any questions now from the floor?
That's an interesting question, because some of my experiences with government agencies indicate that through their various partitioning into subdivisions and so on and so forth, they have the same problem, where you'll have a technology office of the of one organization interested in getting technology into the field and funding efforts to simply get the technology involved in medical care, and yet not paying any attention or significant attention to how you're going to evaluate the effects of that technology's being there and how you're going to mesh it and intertwine it with the training of these new type allied health workers and so on. I think that obviously the role of the federal government is a crucial one, because by and large they're the ones who have to pay the bill for this kind of research. At the moment, it's not even clear that the services of physician assistants and nurse practitioners will be reimbursed. That means that experimental healthcare delivery systems have to be paid for as research projects. That's in a state of flux right now. Obviously, it's going to change soon. But I don't know how to answer your question except to sort of issue a plea that somehow in the funding of technology specifically, since we're interested in technology here in one specific application, that the people who give out the money get together in such a way that when technology is applied, it's going to be applied in a system which has enough measures and is fit into a generalizable enough model that that some of the answers will in fact be useful elsewhere. I guess all I can say is let's see if we can't make it happen better than it seems to be happening now.
I guess my real question was, I have to plead ignorance. I hear all this talk about healthcare delivery, and I see all these experimental systems going on. Is there right now a government agency at the federal level that is concerning itself with coordinating all this thing moving?
Well, I think, you know, I think at a certain level, HEW certainly is, you know, that, you know, at some level in HEW, people are concerned with integrating these things. I'm not familiar enough with the inside workings of HEW to answer that question. Al, you might know better, living in the government.
I might direct your attention. I, while knowing, having been a bureaucrat for about 10 years, I have learned a little bit about the federal government, but I must admit I will say that I'm nothing more than an outside observer of the affairs of the Health, Education, and Welfare Department.
Is that mic on, or is it working? I don't tap it.
Okay, I guess it's,
yeah,
no, it's
I guess,
working.
All right. There's quite a noise level from this ventilation, I noticed.
The point is the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare is a very complex organization for many reasons. It is not just a problem of someone within the federal executive saying, I'd like to draw these organization blocks. The way an organization is structured is dependent upon both the executive and the Congress, and it is just a very complicated organization. However, I believe there is an organization within there, the Health Services and Mental Health Administration, which is primarily concerned with the application of medical knowledge to health care rather than the generation of new knowledge such as in the National Institutes of Health.
The MR system, the Cosmic Information Retrieval, the National Library of Medical Field, is there a similar information retrieval system that's available to HUD to give information about urban problems and address the executive department or question?
That was a great desire at one time a few years ago, and any such idea like that is we just don't have something. All I can say is we have the National Technical Information Service, and that's the primary place where we put our research results out.
I hesitate to ask this because sometimes it inhibits people from asking questions, but I think while we want to keep everything informal, if the people who ask questions would identify themselves, it helps us to get acquainted a little bit better. So I'll ask this, if unless you have some objection, the gentleman in here.
He alluded to the problem of inertia of the civil service. I wonder if he has any suggestions for what we can do with this serious problem. Probably, my name is Donald Levinson. I'm from Reading, West Virginia.
You got the problem out there too, huh? I'm not really sure what I think the answer varies from place to place. It has in part to do with the how much willingness and time the elected official, the mayor in a city, for example, has got to deal with that problem. Perhaps more importantly, how much recognition people are prepared to give to that reality. And most people are not in the cities are not really prepared to discuss that as something that does exist. The civil servants and the other municipal employees are becoming more and more highly organized and less productive. There seems to be a direct relationship or an inverse relationship. The more highly organized, the less productive they are. But I'm not prepared yet to say that they cannot have given you know, sufficient information and motivation and supervision be productive. And I think we just have to begin dealing with that better than we have. It's maybe a psychology of administration, public administration. We haven't yet fashioned well enough to make it useful for us.
Gentlemen in here.
Well, I think the questioner is quite correct that there are some difficult trade-offs to make here in terms of how to finance these sort of proposals that we had. There's another dimension, though, to this urban city hall, other than just someone who's at work, let's say, needing to call on city hall. There's the person who's not working needing to call. There's the person with a potential illness. There could be a clinic in this sort of a facility connected by two-way television to a nearby hospital to make the decision as to whether that particular individual ought to go on to the hospital and so on. I think, though, we have to get the dimension of the cost of those things in perspective. And I dare say if you were talking about a $1 per something tax bill, the cost of those types of facilities would be a tenth of a cent of that tax bill. The thing that is misleading us and is the present distribution of costs in the city relative to such things as support of the concept of the individualism provided by a car. If you ever track that down, it is a fantastic bill. It includes not only all your streets, all your maintenance facilities, it includes your parking facilities, your expressway access points, it includes your traffic control, your policing systems relative to traffic. It goes on and on into the insurance field and everywhere else. Now, if you start to take a look at the cost makeup of a city in terms of how they're being distributed for different functions of the city, in this case, the function there is, to go back to my body concept, is the circulatory function, the movement of energy around the city, in this case, energy in terms of people. There may be other forms in terms of truck moving food and things like that. But there is a fantastic cost going into that distribution system. And each year, we spend a little bit more to enlarge it in some way. I wanted to comment, and I'm going to use your questions to take off on this, to Mr. Hedenberg's points, which I think are excellent, and I don't want to get them lost, because we are just at a dead end. If we sit here and just plop our book down on the table, we have to offer some way to get between where Mr. Hedenberg is and where the engineers are. He is saying straight facts of what the real life is in the city. Somehow, then, within the constraints of the fact you aren't going to get any more money, let's start right from that point, and don't think in terms of the fact you're going to go knocking on the federal government walls. You just start with the point you aren't getting more money. What are the trade-offs of the money that one can do within a city to get a better value for the functions that need to be performed within a city? And I think one of the big jobs then for city planners is not the 2020 job that you were talking about, but rather to identify the crossroads. In other words, when the new appropriation is coming up for some more concrete, someone ought to be blowing the whistle and saying, look, have you started to look at the fact, should we perhaps not put it any more into concrete, but start putting it into cable instead of concrete? And this is where I think city planners can do the job. Not looking for more total funds, but saying within those funds, like in your own household, you're always operating within your own funds, but you're trading off. You're deciding your values are different. You want to put more value on one thing or another. We're finding now that in the city life that our values are changing and the present style of the city is not our value, not our thing. All right, let's find out what is the thing we'd like to have and how are we going to trade off.
in terms of the income that we have in a city to get more of the values that we want. Before we go out with hat in hand trying to find more money and keep all the old functions still going and try to create some new ones, it ought to be a sunken trail. So I urge strongly that city planners turn their attention to identifying the crossroads, identifying for city managers where this crucial decision is, identifying the trade-off values between fields such as transportation, communications, food supply, housing, the various functions, and take a look at whether there can be some shifts over some time. Now, I'm off your question, but I think that it still addresses in a broader way what you were getting at.
I think with respect to your question and also with some of our other discussion, that our feeling is that many of these things have to be economically self-supporting. Now, there is developing in the cities a cable television system which can perform various services. It's also possible to ride piggyback on the development of this cable television system a variety of other telecommunication services. And this matter of contact with the centers of information and so forth can very well be designed into the cable television system as they are growing and are bound to grow in the future. It may many of us think that perhaps the cable television system may be the big communication jump of the next decade, as television was in the decade of the 50s. And it is possible to build into that two-way, both wideband and narrowband, depending upon the actual service, that type of communication. And in general, probably the cities in giving out franchises should not look in terms of how they can make money for other services, but should make sure that as they give franchises for these cable television services, that they insist on the communications needs of the city, including the various networks that were discussed by Dick, that they be essentially built into the city as this particular service is developed, which is hopefully going to be economically viable.
Bill, may I make another comment too? Yeah. On the same line, in cable television, let me just remind you of the new rules of the FCC with regard to new cable television systems, where the requirements are a limitation on the amount of funds from franchise fees, but a requirement for at least 5 years of a channel being made available for educational purposes.